both the Pentagon and Congress are missing potentially a critical piece of national security strategy as Congress prepares to review and negotiate on the fiscal 2015 National Defense Authorization Act. Barry Pavel is vice president of the Atlantic Council, director of the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security, and former special assistant to the president and senior director for defense policy and strategy in the National Security Council staff, and served both President Bush and President Obama. He is writing about policymakers' need to consider a formal strategy to address the power of the individual. Barry, it's great to talk to you again, as always. Before we start, you're writing in Defense News about the power of the individual. What exactly are you referring to as an or the individual, Barry?
Well, thanks very much, Francis, for having me on your show again. It's always a pleasure, and I always learn from my discussions with you. I mean, what I'm not suggesting is that nation states are going away, but what I am suggesting is for the first time in human history, the power of individuals to achieve major effects and to influence what's going on around the globe is much greater than ever before. And this is enabled by a couple of major trends that are going on. One is the rise of a global middle class that by 2030 is projected to be most of the human population on Earth, about 5/8 of the population. This new middle class will have voracious demands for resources, and they'll have voracious demands for what they see other people have. And again, for the first time, anybody anywhere can see what's going on elsewhere on the globe, and they tend to see things that they want. They want dignity, they want rights, they want freedom, they want prosperity if they can get it. And they will be agitating for this through some of the new tools that technology is now giving them. We're already in the middle of the information technology revolution, which is making it much easier for people to organize through social media. A long time ago, you had to post something on a bulletin board. You could maybe get 100 people. Now, through social media, you can get 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 more mobilized in support of an idea or a set of desires that can change governments. Just right now, we see protests on almost every continent on the globe, and part of the trends that I'm discussing are the reason we're seeing this ferment in what some people call sort of a new age of people power. So what's different is the global awareness, and what's also different is some of the new technologies that are enabling groups to take action for good and to take action for bad, which would mean security threats. The last thing I'd say is we know about the information revolution. What we don't know yet is how the other revolutions that are coming are going to play out. And there I'm referring to the biotech revolution, where some biotech specialists have told me we can now write the code for life. This will have vast implications for people's lifespans, but it will also have vast implications for people making errors as they experiment with biological organisms. We have a revolution in production, which is called 3D printing or 4D printing or additive manufacturing, where people will be able to send designs over the internet and produce objects that will be of increasing sophistication over time. We have a robotics revolution going on, including unmanned aerial systems, but also other unmanned vehicles, and over time, driverless cars. All of this is being built on the internet, which is a rather unstable foundation still. And I worry that the instability that we're hooking all of these technologies on the foundation of the internet could lead to even greater potential risks and vulnerabilities, as well as the enormous opportunities that all of that creates. So what I've tried to do is sort of outline the ecosystem, if you will, of where I see the new power of individuals and groups to act on what I would now call the global stage. I wouldn't use the word international anymore because it only accounts for nation states.
One of the reasons I like to have you on the program, Barry, is you're not shy about putting some ideas on the table for us to discuss, my friend. There's a lot there.
There's a lot there, yeah.
Where I'd like to start, though, is where you alluded to it a moment ago, and you write in this piece in Defense News, we have it linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, the U.S. government should look to harness the ongoing global changes to its national advantage. And you write about some of the issues that the Defense Department and the United States government as a whole should be looking at there. I guess I take some solace, some comfort in the fact that when I look around the world and I look at what is happening in Syria and what's happened throughout the Middle East during the Arab Spring, I look at what's happened in China, I look at what's currently happening in Thailand, nobody else seems to have a better idea or a more stable idea on how to handle this idea of the individual and what those individuals together as groups mean. I mean, we're thinking just this week, today, about the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, something that nowadays seems rather commonplace as we think about a kind of citizen uprisings may not be the right word, but citizen congregations, and they turn into something. 25 years ago, that was completely unheard of, and that's what made it so unusual and historic in China. But it doesn't appear that anybody else around the world has any better idea how to cope with this than we do. Is that fair to say, do you think, Barry?
Well, I think this is the beginning of a long series of conversations about the new world that I think, and I've written, we are already in. It took a while, I'll use a bad analogy, but it took a while after the dawn of the nuclear weapons age for academics, government policymakers, ordinary citizens, et cetera, to get a handle on what does this mean, how do we think about it, what are the core dynamics associated with this new awesome power that can do great damage, but in some ways has also served as a stabilizing factor in rivalries between nation states. I think we're only at the very beginning of a conversation that's much more complex than that, that has many more actors, a lot more dynamics going on, a lot of other changes in the world that, as I said in my article, I think the United States needs to start looking to harness the changes and somewhat rebalance the other aspects of our strategic portfolio. And here I'm referring to our strong emphasis on seeking stability in key regions of the world, the Middle East, Asia. And I do think stability in many cases is a good thing, but I think it's no longer what it used to be. And I don't think anybody looks at the Middle East right now and says, boy, we want things exactly as they have been. There are some things that we do want stable, but there's a lot of things we want to ride these changes, and we want to use them to make the world a better place and to strengthen and advance United States interests. Because as the president said in his recent speech in West Point, America should not be afraid of individual empowerment. In fact, we're strengthened by it. Mm-hmm. And that's almost a direct quote. I think he's right in that case, but we need to figure out how to move towards this new age where it's a completely different and somewhat uncomfortable set of new concepts and new trends that we have to figure out a new framework for dealing with.
I noticed you came right out of the gate, Barry, with the disclaimer almost that I'm not proposing nation states are going away. So you're very clear about that. And yet I did also note at the a couple of moments ago that you're now referring to the world in which we live as a global world and not an international world, because nation states are not the only consolidators of power anymore. What's the implication for that if you're sitting inside the Pentagon or you're sitting in Congress or you're sitting in some other executive branch office and trying to figure out what is the world? I hate to use the term New World Order, but I can't think of a better one. What does the New World Order look like in 5 to 10 to 25 years so that then we can figure out how to strategize around that, not necessarily even to leverage anything, but just to figure out what America's role as a nation state is in a world that looks like it might potentially look?
Boy, I mean, that's if I could answer that question, I would have already been hitting the circuit.
Okay, well,
as I said, we're at the beginning of a set of conversations that will take years, if not a decade. But I think I'm starting to see traction. I'm starting to see strong discussions on this, including with senior officials in places like the Pentagon and elsewhere, about some recognition that yes, we are in something different. And let's keep talking about what it means. The trends that I've talked about are, I think, key, but there's other trends too. There's an energy revolution going on using the shale, from shale technology that's making the United States one of the new energy powers in the world potentially, and shifting the center of gravity for energy away from the Middle East and towards other regions. There's an urbanization revolution going on as well. So there's a lot of things being thrown into this mix. I think change is the new normal, and I think conversations like this are going to have to become more commonplace so that we can begin to grope our way towards, at first, an understanding of what's going on and what are the key things we need to look at, and then second, the wisps of a new strategy that would not completely let go of the old, because we still have major nation states throwing their weight around. I mean, let's not forget what China's doing in the South China Sea and the East China Sea as we speak, what Russia's doing in Ukraine and looking to do elsewhere as we speak. So let's not be Pollyannish that old classic nation-state rivalries, competition, and potential crises are going away, because they're not. But they're now added, they're now joined by this new set of factors that will also affect how nation-states behave going forward. So it's complex, but I think if we start to identify some of the key building blocks, we can move our way towards as successful a future for the United States and for our allies and partners and for our people as we've seen in the recent past.
You've touched on a number of things already in our conversation, and you talk about more of them in your piece that are potential disruptors but don't appear maybe on the surface to be national security issues or risks. And when we come back from the break, I want to review some of those. Barry Pavel of the Atlantic Council, my guest, he's writing in Defense News about the power of the individual and the implications on national security strategy, my guest on Pentagon Solutions today. And our conversation continues in a moment on In Depth with Francis Rose. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. My Pentagon Solutions guest today is Barry Pavel, director of the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council and a former Defense Department and National Security Council staffer. You're writing in Defense News, Barry, about a strategy. The headline, actually, is U.S. needs strategy for a Westphalian plus world. And you explain the riff there on the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, which I quite honestly, I had to go to Wikipedia to find out a little bit about. So I commend you for talking about something that caused me to learn and expand my horizons. But you write here about some potential technologies that will cause disruptions in the national security sphere, and they're technologies that I don't think of or didn't until I read your piece and considered a little bit, didn't think of as obviously national security potentially disruptive. You know, you write about robotics, and I think of drones, and that's pretty obvious. But there are some others. You mentioned 3D and 4D printing, which I didn't think of until I read this piece at all. And that becomes obvious because if you can produce anything you need at any place in the world with very simple resources on hand, that's pretty obvious. What are the potential national security implications, though, of something like algorithms and the biotechnology explosion that you mentioned earlier?
Sure. And one of the principles I bring to this is that all of these technologies have enormous potential for good, but they also can be used for darker purposes. Algorithms in particular, we've seen some of the enormous benefits of how in many parts of our economy, and there's some very interesting literature on this, machines are talking to machines in places where people used to be involved in the loop. When a ship pulls into a major harbor in Europe, it's scanned by equipment on land that knows and registers that this ship is coming in. There's no humans involved. But we've also seen some of the complexities and complications that machines talking to machines can produce. We've seen flash crashes in our financial system, for example, based on, again, machines only in the loop with no people. And so I'm a little worried about the future where perhaps we have driverless cars on a grid and some complexity in the code or some situation comes up or someone hacks into a system and the car, which is not controlled anymore by people goes somewhere where it was not intended to be, or encounters a situation where it wasn't intended. Whenever there's complex systems with no humans in the loop and not sufficient fail-safe, you get some funny and potentially deadly outcomes. And so I worry about the national security manifestations of machines being involved and humans not causing some instability in our daily lives. Biotech, as I suggested earlier, we're going to have longer lifespans. There's already a burgeoning literature on what it means to have a population where there are routinely 100-year-olds, 110-year-olds, some books that I can recommend for those that are interested, solving our most deleterious diseases. We're all the cost of mapping our own genomes is dropping precipitously, so we'll be able to tailor medicine and medical treatments for individual circumstances on a much cheaper and more effective basis over time. But I also worry about what I call bioerror or bioterror. We have lots of people now experimenting with biological organisms. They call it hacking, which just means experimenting, in a way that we didn't have before. And so the centers of activity that are playing with biological organisms, producing new capabilities that better society, are proliferating. But I worry about an error where something happens, where an organism can cause mass population casualties or death. And I, of course, worry about bioterror, where the capabilities, I think, for a biological terrorist attack are proliferating as well. So I don't think we're prepared for that world yet sufficiently. And when I ask my Pentagon, my former Pentagon colleagues, both in public settings and in private settings, they agree with me. They're not ready for that yet, and they're trying hard to catch up. They're getting more in touch with the biological technology community, et cetera. So I think the conversations are starting to have an effect, but we're not yet where we need to be on some of these technologies that I think we will be surprised how they manifest themselves in a national security dimension. But I'm unfortunately rather confident that that kind of thing is going to happen in some form.
You use the term hacking, and others use the term hacking for some of these technologies that are not associated with cyber technology, where we normally think of that term, and it strikes me as particularly appropriate. There are parallels. I mean, it sounds like with some of the things that you're talking about, algorithms and biotech and the 3D and 4D printing, as I look at some of these other robotics, there's potential from various types of threat actors similar to the landscape that we see in the cyber landscape today. The insider threat, the external threat, the malicious threat, the innocent threat, you know, where somebody does something and they didn't think they were making a mistake. They didn't think what they were doing was wrong, but it turned out to be a tremendous error. Is it possible that that world, or that sphere, will provide some framework for terminology, and maybe not strategy yet, but as you say, we're at the beginning of this conversation, and maybe that terminology will make sense to people as we try to figure out a way through all of this?
Yeah, I think you're onto something, and I said we're at the beginning of these efforts, I call them sort of wisps of strategy.
Uh-huh.
There's sort of some feelings that this could become a pillar, or lead toward a pillar of a new strategic approach. And I do think there are some very good analogies from the cyberspace domain, which is private sector run. Private sector driven. I think domains like biotechnology are also private sector dominated, where the main expertise is in the private sector that's experimenting and moving forward with these technologies in such an interesting fashion. There's a lot of individual action that can have broader effect in cyberspace, just like some of these other domains that we're talking about. And I think some of the best strategies, even for future governments to deal with these problems, should be developed, driven, and very much orchestrated by private sector actors for and with government officials. How we do that, it would be another change in the way we need to do business in this country, where a long time ago governments were the center of expertise on on all issues of national security, and they were in very hierarchical structures. We withhold secrets as much as we can. You can see some of that sort of framework eroding, where it's much harder to hold secrets. We need to be more like a networked government and a networked society. We need to be more private sector driven and people driven. I think this changes so much about what we think about in terms of national security, the way intelligence is collected and stored and used, the way our personnel systems in government work, the way we acquire defense equipment. All of that is going to need to change in a world that moves much more quickly than the structures that we still have with us today for dealing with these issues as a nation.
We're almost out of time, Barry, but you wrap this piece in Defense News that's linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth by writing, a dynamic security strategy, that's what you're proposing to call this, would require much more active and agile U.S. leadership in the world than we've seen since the Cold War. I wonder if it's your position that the United States is ready, willing, and able to act in that capacity right now, considering where we are coming out of the two wars and engaged as we are or aren't in various other hotspots around the world.
We are not. We are not ready. The public is only just beginning to get a sense for some of these trends that are coming. The U.S. government and other governments are still only beginning to get a sense for some of these trends that are coming. So this is part of what I mean when I talk about the beginning of a series of conversations, where I think we need to start bringing people into these kinds of discussions so that they start to understand we can't ignore the future that's coming, the future that's already here. We're seeing it pop up in various places and in various forms. We've been lucky so far that we haven't had another sort of strategic shock like 9/11, but I do think we will see individuals and groups having more of an effect with these new capabilities. We're seeing protests spread across the world already and affect other governments. Taiwan, Thailand, Ukraine, Syria, Venezuela, I could go on and on. And so the thinking that we can go on with business as usual as these trends are beginning to sort of insinuate themselves into the rest of the world, and we are so intertwined with the world in terms of our economy, our society, our politics, our security, there's no way we can escape it. So this is just a conversation and a learning journey that we're all going to have to be on together.
Barry, there's a lot more we could cover, and we're out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. But it's always wonderful to have you on the program. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Barry's writing under the headline, U.S. Needs Strategy for a Westphalian Plus World, in Defense News. Barry Pavel of the Atlantic Council, and you can find a link to that, and you can hear my conversation with Barry later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.